What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks as always for subscribing, downloading and rating and letting people know about the show generally. We really do appreciate it. If you'd like to contact us here on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to have a really interesting discussion, understanding what happens when our neurons fire and where those charges go as they follow on the path of our thinking and movement. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us via Skype are Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway and from iCRAG, Dr. Fergus McAuliffe. Fergus, you might remind us what iCRAG do.
So iCRAG, it's the Science Foundation Ireland Research Centre for Applied Geosciences. So we study all aspects to do with the Earth, its environment, its resources, and how people are connected to the Earth.
And so is summer a busy time for researchers going out in the field? Do they all have pickaxe and cargo shorts?
Some do, some don't. The Earth really never goes away, so we're busy all year round, especially during the summer months, and certainly pre-COVID, we would be really, really busy during the summer months. We do some caving work, and that is often easiest to do during the summer because the water levels are a lot farther down in the ground, so we can get farther into the caves.
Oh yeah. Have you spelunked?
I have spelunked. Being 6'4" in height makes it a little bit awkward for me to spelunk. So there's a lot of crawling on hands and knees. But yeah, it's an experience if you haven't done it before.
Indeed. Let's have a look at our stories. Our first story, Jessamine.
Portland, you're flirting with record temperature territory. We're talking about all-time record highs, which was 107 degrees within the city. The forecast temperature tops that this weekend from Saturday into Sunday. Of course, there's still time to get the exact details ironed out, but look at the average high for this time of year, 76 degrees. So we are running 30 degrees above average for this time of year.
Has to do with the incredible amount of heat that the globe is now experiencing and will do into the future.
Yeah, if you've been watching the news at all, you'll have seen that in my home continent of North America, there's been a terrible heat wave over the last couple of weeks, specifically in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of the heat records there were not just broken, but shattered by as much as 5 degrees Celsius.
I didn't realize it was that much. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge heat wave. And even at a similar latitude to Ireland, there was a temperature recorded of 49.6 degrees Celsius, which is just unheard of, basically. And this was in the city of Lytton, which unfortunately was almost immediately after this destroyed by a forest fire. So this heat wave is causing, you know, not just the heat and heat stroke and people and, you know, damage to infrastructure and everything, but also more and more natural disasters. So new analysis has come out this week from the World Weather Attribution Group, which is researchers from Oxford, the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute, and other places, basically looking at how likely was this event to occur, and based on historical data, but also looking at the impacts of man-made climate change. And they basically show that this would have been nearly impossible to happen without climate change, but it was 150 times more likely because of the 1.2 degrees Celsius increase that we've already experienced due to, you know, carbon in the atmosphere, that kind of thing. And these other types of extreme events are just going to be more and more likely to happen in the future as we get up to, you know, 2 degrees Celsius and further warming. So it really underscores how important it is to limit the change that we're causing to the atmosphere, because this is just going to get worse and worse. And I have to say, for me, as someone who like grew up in the Mountain West of the US and experienced a forest fire in my hometown as a teen, This is just horrifying to read about because you don't want these kind of things to get more and more common. You know, you want them to be rare. They're so, so disruptive, both in terms of lives lost and then also just things being destroyed.
Yeah, and I suppose the we know unless we find a way to take carbon out of the atmosphere in significant amounts, we haven't yet even started to go backwards yet. We haven't even stopped increasing the amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere. So the likelihood of these events presumably much, much higher as the next decade rolls on.
Yeah, it's going to get more and more common. And there are some people saying as well now that we could potentially be underreporting these extreme climate events that are already happening because places like North America are very well covered by sensors. They're often, you know, reported on in the news. But other places like sub-Saharan Africa or Siberia that have also experienced heat waves and extreme climate events, you might not hear as much about it if there's fewer sensors in place or it's just not making international news. So it could be even worse than we know, which is just another reason that, you know, that we have to act.
In terms of mitigation strategies for something like extreme heat wave, I mean, do societies in areas likely to experience these sort of increases, do they need to adapt? I mean, because you imagine a huge culture change is required to exist if that sort of thing becomes more common. How you farm, how you live, how you consume needs to change to be able to live in something 40 plus, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, what you need as a person to live in those areas is changing, and it's changing fast, as well as how easy it is or isn't to do things like farming or ranching. But I think what's really, you know, important to realize about this is that it's not just about the way that people are behaving who live, you know, in the desert Southwest or in these areas that are experiencing this extreme heat. You know, it's the globe as a whole. The carbon emissions are global. So really everything that, you know, that we're doing here or that people are doing in other parts of the world, like it's all interconnected. So we all have to work together to make those changes if we want to improve things.
Well, maybe one of the things we could improve is stop traveling to work at least one day a week. Fergus, this is results from an experiment to do just that and see what the effects of a four-day working week are. Tell us about it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a study that took place in Iceland from 2015 to 2019. So it's pre-COVID, and that's quite important because I guess since COVID arrived and with the sort of change in working scenarios and conditions, lots of people are talking about like the new way of working involving more time at home, less time spent in the car, perhaps even moving to a 4-day weekend. And this is something that countries like Spain and New Zealand are seriously considering sort of post the Great Reset. But crucially, what they did in Iceland from 2015 to 2019 is that they undertook a very large scale study whereby they followed 2,500 people over the course of 4 years. And so that 2,500, that's more than 1% of the entire working population of Iceland. So wow, it was a really, really big sample. And what they did is that they sort of altered, and now this is carried out in the public sector, but they altered their working week so that they would only work 4 days a week and they would actually work fewer hours. So rather than 40 hours, it was down to about 35 or 36. This was, and the study was carried out in a range of working environments. So it was offices, shops, hospitals, and daycare centers. And throughout the trial, the workers were interviewed and so data was gathered on their well-being and also on how they found all of the different changes that happen in the workplace. And some of the findings are really, really interesting. So when it comes to, say, for instance, on the life side of the work-life balance, most of the participants in the study, they reported that they had a lot more time and more energy for things like socializing, for exercising and for hobbies. And also the cut-in hours allowed them to spend more time with their families, and also easier for them to take part in sort of chores at home. Some of the really big benefits were seen in single parent families and also in households that, you know, say where the partner is a heterosexual, then the men were able to take part more in the household chores. So some really positive benefits there on the life side. And then on the work side, productivity was, it was both maintained and in many instances actually improved in the majority of workplaces.
Wow.
And that was largely put down to actually better morale at work. And some of these changes were really interesting. So some of the ways that people, I guess, improved their productivity is that they actually shortened meetings, or they actually didn't do meetings at all, and they did things via email. One downside, it would be they removed the longer coffee breaks. I am a fan of a long coffee break, I have to say. So they shortened those. And crucially, something that didn't happen was this idea of lost hours. Yeah. So what this means is that the fear was that people would unintentionally do overtime because they couldn't fit everything in, and that did not happen.
Wow. Are you listening, Irish employers? Very interesting. Our third story is about supercomputers, Jess, and there's a lot of chat about quantum computing at the moment. This is a supercomputer specifically for healthcare research.
Yeah, so this is a supercomputer that's been newly built in the UK by NVIDIA, and it's designed specifically for doing machine learning type research about healthcare. It's now one of the fastest supercomputers in the world. And what's interesting about this is there have been a lot of machine learning for healthcare kind of projects and companies that have started up over the last few years, mainly because if you have a large data set, you can start looking for things that are a little bit harder to spot sort of by eye or by individual clinicians. You know, you can look for things like genetic factors that lead to illness. You can use machine learning to look at different sort of radiographical images or things like that to try to analyze them better. But this data set that they're going to be using is the UK Biobank data set, which is about 500,000 middle-aged people in the UK who are going to be followed for about 30 years. This computer has incredible capacity to look at basically every aspect of these people's healthcare to try to understand a little bit better how we can do preventative and targeted treatment for them. So for example, one of the projects that they're going to be looking at to start out with has to do with what's called immuno-oncology, where basically you're looking at people who get cancer and how you can use either drugs or other interventions to get their immune system to sort of join in to fight against the tumors that are in their system. So it's really interesting as a field, but it's also a really difficult field to do. And figuring out what drugs are going to be effective for different people is very, very time consuming. So having this incredibly powerful supercomputer that's designed specifically for these kind of applications is potentially going to be huge. I think this sounds amazing. One of the concerns that I had looking into it, though, is that the large data set that they're using, UK Biobank, it's been described as healthy, wealthy, and white in terms of its overall people that are enrolled in it. It's people who are 40 plus, which already gives a little bit of bias in terms of who makes it to that age. But also, you know, you want to have medical interventions for the full spectrum of people. So, you know, ideally, you would want a data set that reflects basically all parts of society. My hope is that they'll start out with some trials of this approach on the data set that they have, which is good and which is well understood, and then maybe start to recruit or come up with other more diverse data sets. Because when you have this kind of potential for improvement in healthcare, you really want it to reach people at every level and every part of society.
Yeah, and excluding people from research obviously can lead to disasters, as we've seen before. Thalidomide, you know, not testing drugs on a wide range of people and just assuming, oh, that works for this person, it's probably going to work for that person. Very interesting. Our final story has to do with pareidolia, Fergus.
Yes. So quick question, Jonathan. Do you ever see faces in inanimate objects?
All the time.
Good. Well, so you have what is called pareidolia, and don't worry, you're not on your own. Pretty much everyone is capable of seeing faces in inanimate objects. So we're thinking of things like, you know, you look down at your coffee cup and you can see a face, or you might look at a plug in the wall, or that weird face on Mars, the one that, like, when the sun is at the right angle, it kind of looks like there's a human face looking back at you from Mars, or even all the way to seeing the image of Christ on a piece of burnt toast. We're really primed as humans to see faces. And this is really important because we're such a social species. So we need to be able to quickly, I guess, figure out or determine when we meet someone, are they friend or are they foe? Are they a family member or are they someone that we don't know? Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they angry? And all that happens in milliseconds. And so the researchers in this particular study from the University of Sydney, they were trying to see if those same patterns play out when we see faces in inanimate objects. And they also wanted a test as well if this thing called priming happens. So if you show someone a human face that is angry, they are more likely to think that the next face that they see is also slightly on the angry side.
And really, though? Isn't there? Okay, because there's been sort of back and forth on priming, but interesting. Okay, go on.
And that also plays out in terms of attractiveness. So if you show someone a picture of someone who's quite attractive and then immediately followed up with another picture of a different face, then that second face is going to be deemed to be slightly more attractive because you've been primed. So what the researchers did in this particular study is that they showed a mixture of real human faces and inanimate objects to a number of different individuals. So they had both sort of happy human faces and sad and also angry human faces. And then they also played that out across the inanimate objects as well. So if you get a chance to look online, you can see some of the inanimate objects that they showed. So there were some very, very happy looking coffee cups, some bags, a very, very happy looking Swiss roll and an apple pie. And then also a fearsome looking and really angry looking green pepper that was cut down the middle. And when you look in the side, it looks absolutely terrifying. So they showed these pictures to the study subjects. And what they found was that those same patterns of priming that occur when we look at human faces also play out the exact same way when we look at inanimate objects. And this has some potential uses maybe down the line in things like when we're looking at artificial intelligence, so like software recognition of faces, nice. Or even potentially helping with face blindness as well. So there are potential uses there to this rather strange study.
You can find these images on our Twitter page. It's at News Talk Science. Dr. Fergus McAuliffe from iCrag, Dr. Justin Fairfield from NUI Galway. Thanks as always. Now, when we think about life and understanding it all, we might first look outward to the cosmos and our place within it. But if we stop for a moment and look a little closer to home, you might find there's also a profound and breathtaking depth within us too. Well, some of us. Each and every movement, sense, memory, and thought, every single action, a tiny electrical pulse, a spike of energy that passes between our brain's neurons. Can we learn from these things? Can we even measure them? Well, Professor Mark Humphreys is chair in computational neuroscience at the University of Nottingham and author of a new book called The Spike, An Epic Journey Through the Brain in 2.1 Seconds. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Mark. Why 2.1 seconds?
That's a really good question. In part, it was a decision to show just how much is going on in your brain at every second. So as I say somewhere in the book, your neurons in your cortex send about one of these electrical pulses you mentioned in the intro every second. So that means that across your cortex, there is 17 billion spikes in a second. So even though it's 2.1 seconds, there are 34 billion plus spikes in your cortex alone for which to understand, which is quite an epic thing to do. So even longer would have been an even harder task to tell.
All right. So how do we know about these neurons? What are we able to measure? Because you're talking about so many interactions within the space of just a single second. Is it possible or is it even useful to understand what goes on at a single neuron level? What can we record and what do we know so far?
So we've been able to record from individual neurons for almost exactly a century now. It's like the mid-20s when the technology first got to the point where you could lower an electrode into the brain of an animal, mostly normally are the biggest neurons are connected directly to the muscles, and pick up the individual electrical pulses from each neuron. And it was obviously, as soon as it became apparent that neurons talk in these pulses of electricity to each other, and that neurons talking to each other is how we do everything, it's how we sense, how we think, how we act, then it became a passion for many researchers then to find out what those spikes, those pulses are encoding about the world. Because if we want to fundamentally understand how brains work, we need to know what those messages are that neurons are being passed between each other. So even when we can record, as we did through sort of the 1920s through to the early 90s, we record one neuron at a time, and we're getting an animal to do something, or it's showing it a picture or something, we can still pick up the diversity of responses that neurons have or have not. Often what our most informative stuff has come from when we recorded from neurons, and they haven't responded the way that we thought they would. So then we can look deeper into the brain from where that neuron is and find out what it's sending the next neuron along. And it's only in the last sort of 2 decades have we suddenly had this explosion of the ability to record from many neurons, individual neurons at the same time. So indeed, just in February this year, there was an announcement that a team in New York can now record 1 million neurons simultaneously from the cortex of a mouse, which means that we're getting from the individual neuron scale, where, as you've said, how much can we learn from single neurons? We're getting close in simpler animals to the scale of recording from large chunks of their brains at once.
Okay, so I have a problem with scale here, right? If we're talking about recording from an individual neuron, surely that means some sort of wire or some sort of sensor in each of those neurons. If we have, 85 or thereabout billion neurons in our head, how on earth do we fit a wire into a single neuron? And how do you do that with 1 million neurons?
So there's the question of how can we record neurons in our brains is a separate and difficult question of the fact that we can't do it in our brains the same as we do it in animals. So in animals, it's the question of how do we get a recording device next to each of those neurons. And traditionally, yes, it was a piece of wire or multiple bits of wire that you'd lower into their brain.
I guess like one of these matrices, it kind of looks like a bed of nails. That sort of like a mini bed of nails, and you'd sort of just push that into the brain tissue. Is that right?
Yeah. So one type is exactly that. It looks exactly like a bed of nails. It's like a 10 by 10 array of these little tiny spikes that are put straight on top of the cortex and record neurons in the top few layers.
And are these neurons particularly big, or are they? I mean, it doesn't seem like if you've got something that visible, they're really, really tiny.
So absolutely minute. Yeah. So there's, I mean, the body of a neuron is less than the width of human hair, many times smaller. So they're invisible to the naked eye. So that means that you have to, the only way you know you've recorded from a neuron is if you've lowered an electrode and you happen to pick up the pulses being sent.
Okay, you can't choose which neuron you're looking for.
Not with the wires, no. Okay. But the way we can now record all these many, many hundreds or thousands or even now this million neurons is we don't do it with wires, we do it with imaging. So basically we video the brain. So we get the neurons to take up some kind of chemical that fluoresces the more active they are. So they're sending out more photons, and the more photons they send, it picks up by the camera. And you can use a microscope then to zoom in on that bit of the brain and see the individual neurons at high magnification and see them fluorescing. So you actually see them being active.
Wow. So then in an animal, that means cutting off some of the skull, putting a glass plate or something, or a camera, attaching that camera to the side of the brain and recording the image in that way, which is why we don't do this a lot in humans.
Yeah, so for if you record the top layers of cortex, you can indeed just open up the skull, put the camera in, you can thin the skull to make it transparent. You could just sand it down until you can see through it. There are certain animals that are used in neuroscience because they are transparent. So we use baby zebrafish a lot because they are see-through. So you can just record straight through their heads to their brains. That's really handy. But yes, if you want to go any deeper than the top 2 or 3 layers of cortex, because you have a light source going in, it scatters, you can't get it light to go further. You have to put a fiber optic deep in the brain, or you have to put a microscope actually into the brain and gouge a big hole in the process, which, not in humans.
Okay, so I've got all that, and I knew bits of it, but I've got a really clear picture now. So now you can see this pulse or this spike, as your book and neurologists call it. Those spikes, are they uniform? Is it just a binary on-off? Does a neuron just fire and that's it? Or are there levels of firing? Is there a difference in the length it might fire for? I mean, do we know what happens when that electricity passes from one neuron to another?
Yeah, we know a lot. So each individual spike from a given neuron is the same. So there's all or none. It's a binary thing. But of course, neurons will send a number of spikes. And so as I said, one spike per second is average in the cortex. Of course, some neurons are sending many more than that per second. And there are some theories that neurons communicate by how many spikes they send. And some theories that neurons communicate by when they send spikes. So whether they send it with a delay or a short or long delay after something's happened in the world. And then there are even more complex theories about how neurons send spikes together to a particular target neuron to try and convey information and sort of who is firing rather than when or how many they have fired.
Wow. Okay. And so where is this sort of technology going? Because we can do fMRI, right? We can do functional magnetic resonance imaging, which gives us an idea of blood flow in the brain and shows us what general areas of the brain are firing when we do certain tasks, when we look at a picture, when we feel sad and so on. But recording these individual neurons must give us a much clearer picture. Are we able to decode these messages knowing now what's going on, or do we just have a richness of data and a paucity of analysis at the moment?
So in some parts of the brain that we have a really good understanding of what's going on. We can decode it quite well. So, but those parts of the brain are obviously the bits that are at the ones that receive direct input from the senses, mostly the bits where we can really understand what we've given the brain to do. So, you know, if we show a brain of an animal a picture, then the first bits of the cortex that receive that information from the eyeball, then we can decode pretty well what the individual neurons' spikes are meaning. Particularly in the very first area of the visual cortex, they mean there is a line or some angle in my position of space. And then you can imagine that neurons next to each other encode for little tiny lines that are next to each other. And between across all these neurons firing at different lines and different parts of the picture you're looking at, if you put all those together, then that would reconstruct the image. So we can decode quite well what the neurons in the early visual and early auditory and early smell bits of the brain are doing. But the deeper we go into the brain, the further we get from those senses, the less clear it is. And indeed, we can often, if we recall, say, in the prefrontal cortex, right up the front here in the brain, then we can find neurons there that encode all kinds of weird and wonderful stuff, including the sort of the conjunctions of things happening in the world, like conjunctions of smells and sounds, or abstract things like the value of the reward that the animal has just been given.
Right, because the brain has to take in all of the inputs and make sense of the world. And of course, there may be one neuron that's for a specific place or for a specific color or whatever, but because our world is so textured, that constant firing is our brains trying to make sense of the world around us.
Yeah, so yes, the classic textbook's view of the brain is that there's dedicated sensory areas of cortex which deals with vision, this bit deals with audition, this bit. But of course, that whole has to be put together into a coherent view of the world and also integrated with what you were expecting to happen in the world. Your immediate memories of what just happened in the past, your long-term expectations of what the world should look like. So I mean, even our early visual system is built on our experience. So it has neurons in it that fire to all kinds of angles and lines of stuff in the world because we developed in a world where it has lines and angles in it. If we developed in a world only had horizontal lines in it, we would have no neurons that knew anything about vertical lines. Mm. So even our earliest visual and other sensory systems, they derive a lot of their structure from having to deal with the fused properties of the world together.
For sure. Well, we've evolved to navigate the world that we live in. When it comes to learning all about the mechanics of motor neurons, how we move and how movement is translated from a thought to a cascading sort of waterfall of different actions that fire series of muscles to create sort of fluid movement in an animal. I can see how all those sort of things translate, but isn't there a limit that we'll reach at some point where reading from animals is only going to tell us so much?
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like that humans are theoretically much more complex creatures, and by not, because we can't record from humans very well, right? Do we do it a bit with epilepsy patients pre-surgery and that sort of stuff, but not regularly healthy people recording their activities and learning from that, do we?
No, right. So a big hole in our knowledge is, yeah, we have never, to my knowledge, recorded from single neurons from a healthy human brain. So it's our ways of recording from human brains are also things you mentioned before. So fMRI, we have EEG recording with electrodes placed on the scalp, which is a very sort of gross signal of what the entire cortex is doing. And the only time we look at individual neurons in humans is in extreme cases where we need to intervene to a medical condition or try and correct a medical problem. So you use the example epilepsy. So yes, in epileptic patients, before people with extreme epilepsy go under surgery to have part of their brain removed to try and remove that bit of the brain which is generating the seizures, the surgeon finds the seizures by recording from their cortex, by implanting one of those grids of electrodes on top of their cortex and trying to pick up where that seizure starts. So they're trying to use that to scan. So while it's in there, then other researchers can come in and ask that patient to do some tasks, do some point to some staff, do some ask and answer some questions and record those signals and try and make sense of them. So it's only in those like those little tiny windows of opportunity do we get to see inside a human brain. And if you say that's a really big limit, right? Because we get all this movement and sensation stuff from animals, but that means that there's so much uniquely human things we do that we have no idea of, things like language and reading and maths and music and poetry. And anything that's creative, that's not anything that's subjectively human, we have very little in terms of the neurons and their activity during those things.
And we have the technology to do that, but we have the ethical problem sort of in the way. And does that mean we're sort of walking at a snail's pace when we could be on a TGV when it comes to understanding the brain? If I said, you know, I'm 85, I'm bored with life, I want to consent for you to read some of my neurons, would I be able to do that? Even with informed consent, could I do that?
No, not at the moment, no. So any recording of individual neurons requires some kind of invasive procedure. And so obviously any invasive procedure comes with risks, right? Risks of anything, surgery, risks of infection and problems of just the surgery itself. So that means that there's no mechanism even in place for people to say, I want you to recall from my brain, other than these medical situations. So that means that we're missing a whole bunch of knowledge. So it's no doubt that sort of the neuroscience of our understanding of individual neurons is accelerating at an extraordinary pace. We're generating enormous amounts of data. And some would say that, yes, we have more than enough data from animals that will last us many, many lifetimes before we can understand.
Right.
But if your goal as a researcher is to understand something about the human mind, then there is definitely a gap in our knowledge of between neurons and the human mind.
Do we have from these sort of recordings our understanding of electrical impulses passing from one neuron to another any idea of how consciousness works? I know that's a really big one, but like you can sort of understand how in the moment stimulus is chocolate cake in front of you, you know, it hits some hunger or desire, and then the follow-on is motor cortex picking it up and shoving it into your mouth, right? I can understand that. But how I am, how I think about who I am, my personality must be stored physically somewhere in the brain. Is it in this sea of connections, or is it deposited? Do we know? Is it a physical thing you could actually point at, or is it just the energy moving around in our brains?
So, yeah, I guess it's a big I don't know that one, isn't it? So that's indeed let's talk about in the book about the fact this is the explanatory gap between the fact that there are so many things we like to know about the human mind, and consciousness is for many people the big C at the top of that, and the fact that we only recall these neurons in animals. That means we don't really even have a handle on where to look for the sort of substrates of human subjective experience, whether that be the simple experience of being aware up to the more complex aspects of consciousness, like your meta-awareness, your awareness of being aware, and the qualia, the feel of that chocolate cake or the taste of the coffee or the things that give things their sort of, you know, the richness of your experience. But the thing is, obviously, because we've never been able to record neurons in humans, we've never even been able to ask that question of the data. So we don't know that the answer is or isn't there, because we've never been able to ask the question in the first place. So being able to ask the question would help us a lot to take an awful lot of speculation off, you know, off the shelf, and then get rid of a lot of it and put some new stuff in its place.
That would be good, wouldn't it? Before we wrap up, and let's bring it back to these spikes. And we talked about this 2-second journey that you take the reader through in the book. How far can we trace these neurons? Say, for example, we show someone an image of a monkey, for example. Once that goes into the brain, we can start off, presumably, if it's just looking in the eye, we can trace some of the neurons from the eye. But how quickly do we lose track of where those domino pads disappear off to? I mean, is it very difficult after a very short amount of time to see where the path of that firing goes?
In one respect, yes. So once, obviously the retina, it's nice and simple whether we know exactly where the photons will hit, which cones in the retina, which neurons they're connected to in front of them to turn that the photons into these spikes. When those spikes are then sent from the cells at the back of the retina to the first areas of visual cortex, and we have a really good idea of sort of the gross pathways of, so this bit of the eyeballs gets sent to the thalamus goes to the cortex, that first bit of cortex then sends on to the second bit of cortex, then onto the third bit of cortex. But tracing the actual activity of individual neurons, we get to the very first neurons that the information arrives at in cortex, and we can see really clearly how that information reflects what's happening in the retina. And then as we move another step away, we find lots of neurons whose responses aren't simply sort of summations of those simple responses to the retina. And the further we get away, the more harder and harder it is to see how these responses are simple sort of summations of that starting information.
Yeah, and you can imagine... Yeah. It's also probably then quite difficult to determine, is the spike that I'm seeing now anything to do with that monkey, or is it to do with consciousness, or is it to do with breathing, or is that easy enough to filter out?
Yeah, no, it's not easy enough to filter out. You're quite right. So a huge number, we expect that in the brain, indeed, as I point out in the book, we expect most of the spikes in the brain to not be related to the thing that you think you are doing right now, whether that be licking at a monkey or moving your arm or drinking or whatever. So most of the spikes are going to be what we call spontaneous. So they're going to be generated with no obvious stimuli that's created them or movement that they are preceding. And that means that, yes, we have to work very hard with our analysis methods to try and work out when things are related to the outside world. So typically, that's why we show animals images over and over and over and over again, so we can average away all the other stuff and to see the reliable response that it's seeing. Mm. But of course, the brain doesn't get to average over and over and over and over again. The brain just gets to see it once, and the spikes have gone off, and it says that's a monkey somewhere in your brain. So it doesn't have our ability to average over many presentations. So one of the mysteries then is how the brain works in the moment to moment with being able to distinguish between the stuff that's there doing some spikes there meaning something else, and the spikes that mean the stimulus that's arrived. Hmm. And our best guess is that the spikes are coming up from the visual system, for example, are actually just creating an error signal, a signal which says you expected to see a monkey in front of you, and there is a monkey in front of you, so there is no error in your signal.
Right. I can see why we're still quite a bit away from being able to translate human thoughts to computers or uploading our brains into a computer. This book is really interesting because it's I really appreciate sort of visual language and sort of forensics, and this book has got loads of those sort of simple explanations of this 2 seconds of thought, which, as you say, is such a sea of activity in our brains. Mark Humphreys is the author. It's called The Spike, An Epic Journey Through the Brain in 2.1 Seconds. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sean.
He was very good, wasn't he? It's amazing to think that we all run on these flashes of electricity, that every movement, as I said, every thought, everything is just electricity passing from one place to another. Amazing. All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking about the hunger switch. There are some people who can never be satiated. They constantly feel hungry. And that's because there is a central management switch that if it's broken, you never feel full. Declan says, hi, I've been getting 3 nerves removed from my lower facet on my spine for over 10 years in a pain management clinic. When the nerves are removed, I feel no hunger and I lose a lot of weight, and the hunger only returns when the nerves grow back. Any answers, says Declan. God, that's really interesting. I have no answers, no, none at all. But I'm definitely going to put that to Maureen Shilev Benami, who was from the Wiseman Institute, who has been doing this research. She may have some reasons why that might be. Paul says, great piece on the hunger switch. My son has Prader-Willi syndrome, a genetic condition which has the hunger switch constantly turned on in the hypothalamus, so he never has satiety from food. We'll be willing to talk to you off air about doing a follow-up, but raise awareness of this important and rare condition. Maybe, Paul, that'd be an interesting thing to cover for sure. We'll be in touch. Sean Intala says, hi Jonathan, is that like Prader-Willi disease? Do you know, obviously there is some relationship here. I'm not entirely quite sure what, but I'll have a chat with Maureen and see. We also got a text in from a tweet in from Larry Taylor, who was asking why we use the hashtag Believe in Science. He says, I love Future Proof, but why use Believe in Science as a hashtag? How about Trust Science? Science rocks. Understand science, celebrate science, love science. Believe in Science helps flat earthers and anti-vaxxers claim their beliefs are equal to evidence-based science research. So I have a couple of opinions on this. Number one is we do it because we're supported by Science Foundation Ireland and it is their hashtag. The second is that I don't have as much of an issue with it as some people do. And I'll tell you why. We do have to believe. I mean, there is belief is part of science. We have to believe the evidence that's in front of us. We can't measure everything. We have to believe in the work of other scientists. And I think that we know something for sure, that's not a tenet of science. There's always a question. There's always saying, look, this is what we believe to be the case, given all the evidence that we have. But you'll very rarely corner a scientist into saying this is definitely true. Certainly mathematicians and physicists have a bit of an advantage there. But very rarely will you find anyone say this is always true. And I think a belief in science is important. There is there's a romanticism there as well. I kind of like it. But anyway, we're paid to say it, so that removes any ambiguity. But I am objectively behind the saying. I don't have an issue with it. Thanks for your comments and emails. If you have anything on this week's program or next Tuesday's Future Proof Extra, you can email them into science@newstalk.com and we'll get back to you in the next episode. If you're wondering why I'm rushing through this, is because I'm moments away from jumping in the car and heading west to Lahinch to go surfing, and I'm very excited about it indeed. So thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer Galt Mahal, Steve Daunt and Simon Keane, Steve McLoon, who was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.